Yeah, just a second. Receive a call from our clerk's office Monday, letting me know that the case has been carried over to today, sir.
I received an email.
You received an email?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so you have up to 15 minutes. You may begin the lecture.
Okay, thank you very much. May it please the court, I am Drew Tidwell, and I am the appellant pro se in this hearing. I have several assignments of error that require this court's attention. The trial court erred as a matter of law when calculating child support by averaging my annual gross income over multiple years. Income averaging is not in the statute, thus it is a deviation. The guidelines 20.108.2a and the Richardson case state that a rebuttable presumption in any judicial proceedings for child support shall be calculated first per the guidelines. This did not happen.
Sir, the statute that you make reference to is an appropriate citation, but I believe that the statutory framework also says that the court may use any tools available to it to assess what the appropriate amount of income that should be attributed to any party who may bear burden of support. Do you agree with that principle, sir?
Not entirely. I look at case law, and I look at the West v. West case, and this court found that child support must be based on actual gross income, and then I look to the unpublished Ponacanti case, and this court held that the calculations must be based on current income, the income at the time of the hearing. Averaging income over four years is not actual gross income, and it is also not income at the time of the hearing, the actual income at the time of the hearing. Also, I believe the intent of the statute and the guidelines is that you could go into any court within the Commonwealth of Virginia and get the same presumptive amount based on the evidence. And averaging income, the court basically just did not follow the statute. It's not within the statute is clear and unambiguous. And when we need to look at the four corners of the document to determine its meaning and intent.
Let's take your argument to its. I like to take things to a conclusion. It cannot be it's applicable. Suppose a person, I'm not saying this is you, sir, is earning $100,000 a year, and say they earn $150,000 a second year and $175,000 a third. In other words, their income is continuing to rise. And let's say they were in a sort of business where their income was not predictable all the time, commissions or whatever. There were things that would contribute to this person's income. And when they came to court, they said, well, right now I'm not working. Would their income at that point be determined to be zero, or would the court sort of try to figure out what an appropriate income amount should be?
Well, I believe that the court should figure out what an appropriate amount should be. However, it may also be a deviation, so they should calculate the presumptive amount first, and then they should do their ruling in writing, according to the statute.
How would the court get to the presumptive amount? Did it plug in some figure?
The court could look to maybe the most recent tax returns. Maybe it could look at
To help me out, and I understand, I'm asking tough questions, I'm trying to make sure I understand your argument. If I'm the person who's the payer, the person who's supposed to pay the money, and I had this one average year where I made $175,000, but my income, my gross income, is really $125,000 if you average it, wouldn't it be better for me to have the benefit of having the determination be $125,000 as opposed to that average year where I made $175,000?
I think you need to look with what is best for the children. So, averaging my income, and yes, in this case, my income did go down. However, if the inverse were true and my income went up, averaging would not be in the best interest of the children because the parties, both parents, have X amount of money to pay for child support. And I believe the statute also was created in order to make it so support of the children as if the parties were together. So basically, because the income went down, even if we were still together, there would be less money for child support.
I think I understand what
you're saying. Okay, so I will move on. Another assignment of error is that the trial court used the appellee's demonstrable exhibit of calculations of my gross income for the years of 2012 to 2016. This document was not admitted into evidence, and she offered no evidence to prove her numbers and calculations were correct. Further, my gross incomes for the years 2013 and 2014 were not offered in testimony, and no evidence was submitted to the trial court. Also, this document was not provided to me in discovery, and I received this document when she began her testimony. I objected to these demonstrative exhibits, and the trial court judge stated that these demonstrative exhibits would be marked for identification and not admitted as evidence. This court held in Anderson v. Anderson, demonstrative exhibits without evidence to support them have no probative value. It was not until the trial court's final ruling I found out that my alleged gross incomes from 2013 to 2016 were used by the trial court to average my gross income for the child support calculations. These calculations.
Is it your contention then that there was no evidence of that gross income other than the demonstrative exhibit, which was not introduced into evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So since these alleged numbers that the trial court used were only found in an unadmitted demonstrative exhibit, it was not harmless error. The trial court also used the appellee's demonstrative exhibits regarding work-related child care.
Follow up on Judge Bryan's question. Was there any testimony regarding income?
There was testimony regarding income. However, the testimony for the years 2013 and 2014, I gave testimony about one of my clients, not my actual income. The only time the income numbers were ever said in court were by the judge in his final ruling. So since the numbers were only on this demonstrative exhibit, two of those years which he used were not ever offered in testimony. The trial court had to use the demonstrative exhibit. She did testify.
Okay, did she make any mention of what she believed your income was in that period?
No, not.
There was no direct testimony from her regarding any income levels for 2015 and 16, correct?
2015 and 16, my tax returns were provided for 2015 and my testimony for 2016.
Okay. You're talking about 2013, 2014, right?
Correct. So I'm going to move on. Another assignment of error is that the trial court's refusal to read or consider my pretrial brief. The trial court provided an erroneous reason for not doing so, thus ignoring my pleadings and legal arguments and depriving me of my due process. I correctly followed all the procedures for filing the brief, and the brief was to perform the function of assisting the court to define and identify the issues in applicable law before the trial court. The trial court stated its reasons for not reading the brief was that the court thought I was presenting evidence outside of court. I cannot understand how the trial court can state I was presenting evidence outside the court if the trial court judge did not read the brief. I can find no law addressing a trial court refusing to read a pretrial brief. Another assignment of error occurred when the court refused to consider a cause of action in my petition. This cause of action is a number of days that the custodial parent, the appellee, has illegally deprived me of custody of my children. This cause of action was also discussed in my pretrial brief, which was never read. The trial court refused to hear any discussion on this issue, despite the fact the issue was in the petition, the pretrial brief, and my objections. In the final ruling, nothing is mentioned on this issue, despite it being part of the relief requested in the petition. Evidence that I was illegally deprived custody of my children was submitted to the trial court. The legal deprivation of custody is a custody issue that is before the court, or that was before the trial court, and is also directly linked to support. When she denies me custodial time, her custodial time increases, thus increasing the amount of child support she received. Her actions are causing a loss of consortium between myself and my children. She owes a duty to her children that they not be denied consortium with their father. My final assignment of error is that the trial court abused its discretion by refusing to revise the child support payments retroactively. The trial court ruled on no evidence and only unproven allegations made by the made at trial by the appellee. The court also erred by not permitting me, as raised in my objections, to demonstrate with documentary evidence that her arguments were untrue. In summary, Income averaging was used to determine my gross income. Income averaging is not in the statute. Therefore, it is a deviation. The trial court did not calculate the presumptive amount and did not state the reasons for deviating in the writing. Documents that were not admitted into evidence were used by the trial court to calculate my child support. The trial court refused to read my pleadings, and the trial court refused to address a cause of action that was in the petition. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. As a tradition of...